Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Okay. Before we get started, I want to get you to check out our website, themcguffinmen.com. We've put out a handful of podcasts this year. I talked to Travis about 2014 in review, and James and I have discussed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, City Lights and Charlie Chaplin, and Inherent Vice. Next week, we're going to be talking a bit about the television broadcast of the Super Bowl and television broadcast of sports in general, and also we'll be doing an episode on Eyes Wide Shut. So that's all that's going on right now. Follow us on Twitter. Subscribe to us on iTunes. And, I don't know, make up a Pinterest page for us or something. But yeah, let's get to the episode.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about?
Well, before I answer, just let me have a sip of coffee here. Just one second.
Oh, God, it's a flyby.
Oh, no.
Put the coffee down. You're a VIP and you're drinking your coffee.
All over my Airboss shirt.
Oh, my God.
We are talking about Top Gun today.
Yes.
Long time coming.
Sure. A long time avoided by me, perhaps.
Yeah, sure. It's been on the docket for a while.
Yeah.
Yes, but Top Gun, a classic in certain ways.
Yep.
1986, directed by the late great Tony Scott.
Correct.
Based on an article in California Magazine called Top Guns,
which yeah.
is about you know, this is based on a flight school. I mean, for all the ridiculous stuff in this movie, loosely based on, you know, a true place, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I actually have, like, I have a suspicion that, like, I have nothing to back this up, but I also suspect that this movie is inspired by that article and Jerry Bruckheimer and or Don Simpson seeing The Right Stuff and those two things, like, coming together and then being yeah. like, holy shit, we can do this and make a fuck ton of money.
And then turn all that money into cocaine and put it in their heads.
Yeah. Too soon.
I'm sorry. it's based on the real, you know, Top Gun school in the real fighter town, USA. And currently at that school, it is my understanding that there's a $5 fine for anyone quoting Top Gun.
That's funny.
Yeah, the staff is not allowed to, and I want to know how long it took for that rule to be put in place.
What if you just give somebody the finger? Does that count?
You mean the bird. Can you high five in that certain volleyball way? Is that, it's not a quote, you know?
Yeah, can I just pose with my glistening body in the sun? Like whatever that guy's title card is? Oh my God.
Yeah, there's a lot of silly stuff in here.
Yeah. Our sunsets band, too.
What's your history with this movie?
It's long and storied, I suppose. Many books have been written about it. No, I think this might be the first time I've actually seen the whole thing. Because I had a friend, one of my best friends growing up, I'm still friends with him, but he referred to this as his favorite movie when we were like 12 or something, and we would watch it occasionally. But he would always turn it off immediately after Goose died, and claim the movie's over once Goose dies. And then
it stops being good, or it wouldn't be right to continue.
I don't know. I mean, we were 12. I feel like he didn't have a long explanation. I think we then played like wrestling video games immediately following. So it's not like we were intellectual dynamos. And then like a handful of years later, I think I just saw it clearly after Goose had died, like on TV. And then I was just like, well, I should probably watch the rest of this at some point in my life. But yeah, this is definitely the first time I've seen it the whole way through, start to finish.
And how'd you like it now?
I mean, it has some, I don't know. I feel like everything I like about this movie, I could have gotten from its Wikipedia page, you know? And like, there are some nice shots for sure. Like the shots of the camera, where the cameras are clearly attached to to the jets and stuff like that, that are very cool, and shots in the cockpit of planes that are very clearly in the air. That was cool. But yeah, I don't think it's a very good movie.
Even with your recent defenses of Tom Cruise, you can't,
well, that's the thing. Like, I very much like Tom Cruise. I think Tom Cruise is mostly good in this movie. But it's just, again, it's just more interesting as a stepping stone to Tom Cruise's career than to watch, you know?
Yeah, and Tony Scott's career.
Yeah, oh, I like Tony Scott very much. Mm-hmm. But I'm not saying his... I mean, both Tom Cruise and Tony Scott have made some terrible movies, some together.
And have made individually much better movies than this.
Yes, oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's always fun watching Tom Cruise, like, because he clearly gets to have a lot of fun in this. Mm-hmm. It's super serious, as a lot of this movie seems to want to be taken. There are parts that are just fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, just like, I've seen this movie more than you. I certainly don't watch it over and over or anything.
Every year on the anniversary of Goose's death. Yeah.
Whenever that is.
Yeah.
A very slow rendition of Great Balls of Fire, to remember. The Elton John version.
The balls were slightly less great that day.
But yeah, I mean, just Tom Cruise being Tom Cruise is always fun. And some weird lines of dialogue in this, and some weird
some
deliveries.
Very bizarre dialogue.
Pardon?
Some very bizarre dialogue in this film.
Yeah, and I mean, outside of the things people perceive as homosexual, there's just some very weird, like, when he gets turned down by Charlie the first time when they're still at the bar. Mm-hmm. He says, "I'm gonna need to beer to put these."
Oh yeah,
I'm gonna need to put a beer to put these flames out. Yo, good yeah. work, Mav. Real slick.
And like, he already has a beer and immediately drinks from it. I think he has his hand on this beer while saying "yo." Yeah.
It never looks at a bartender. No bartender hears him. Like, yeah. I have no idea what any of that was.
Maybe this is what inspired him to do Cocktail, so that he never ever again had to wait for a drink. He was now the one who pours.
I guess so. Yeah. Oh.
Some very confusing eyebrow maintenance in this movie as well. Tom Cruise has a full-on unibrow for this whole movie.
Yeah, that was surprising.
That was very surprising. Like, I don't know, certainly the richest person with a unibrow up until, like, Anthony Davis now in the NBA. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not like that's something that you see a lot of in the 80s anyway. Right?
No,
like,
no. It was an interesting choice, you know? That's why you gotta like Tom Cruise. Choices like that.
How do you like the relationship between Kelly McGillis, a.k.a. Charlie, and... Two first name Pete Mitchell, a.k.a. Tom Cruise. a.k.a. Maverick, a.k.a. Mav.
Oh, I don't know. It's like, I roll my eyes a lot. Like, oh, I'm sorry for being direct or whatever. And it's like, oh, she's a strong woman. She says what she wants, what's on her mind and all this shit. Yeah, I don't know. It was just really bad. Like, it wasn't well written, and maybe there's like an interesting line in there, but I might have been too busy rolling my eyes at all the other lines to pay attention. I didn't find much other than very broad, like, 80s statements on women and whatnot. Yeah,
like, because you hate independent women.
Hey, I am on record, I love that Destiny's Child song, big fan of Charlie's Angels one. No, and the thing about the relationship that was weird to me is that Kelly McGillis, Charlie, was kind of treated like an object at some times, and that weirded me out. Like, I think there's a line where Tom Cruise says something along the lines of, "When I see something I want, I just go for it," while looking right at her in her eyes. And that, I remember that being a little creepy, and I don't know, I wasn't totally down with that. But, you know, it's the 80s, different times.
Do you really think it's that bad towards women in this movie?
No, I don't. It's just kind of, I don't know. We saw this very recently with the trailer for The Gambler, where the word "thing" gets mentioned, and then they immediately cut to Brie Larson, and I found that very, very terrible. But that's just something that will always stick out, is when you say the word thing, clearly talking about a person. And I don't know, it's just something that has always stuck out to me. But no, I don't think this their relationship is problematic, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really don't mind it that much. Like, I think it's, as far as, like, things that aren't airplanes flying, it's the most interesting thing in this movie.
Oh, Goose and Tom Cruise have legit chemistry. I would have much rather watched 20 extra minutes of them just talking. You know? I thought yeah. they were so great together.
Yeah, no, they're definitely really funny. And yeah,
that's easily the highlight of the movie to me. Is like, I guess it's kind of just that first scene in the bar where they're talking to each other, and Mav says she's lost that loving feeling or whatever, and he's like, oh, I hate it when she does that, when she loses it, throws something on the ground. Like, that seems very funny. And when they're talking to Iceman and whoever Iceman's partner's called, whatever his partner's called, you
know. Slider,
yeah.
The scene where they're doing Great Balls of Fire together on the piano.
Yeah.
All I could think of is you being in that restaurant and hating all of them.
Oh, I would hate it so much. But here's another thing I was thinking throughout this movie, because there are a lot of times in this movie where, or at least three times, where characters are in bars and there's just no music playing. And I want to go to these bars. Like, I want to be able to go to a bar and have a nice volume conversation, which is, I don't think, anything I've ever experienced in my life. I thought that was very interesting. That is honestly one of the top five takeaways from this movie for me, is that bars used to not have super loud music sometimes.
I guess, maybe, if this movie is an accurate reflection of reality, which it is absolutely not.
I think we have seen so much proof that this movie is basically reality.
Okay, well, since we're on the subject of music.
No, you were talking about Charlie. I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Oh yeah, no, I actually liked her parts a lot. I really like that flirting scene when he's first trying to woo her at that bar. Mm-hmm. I understand your objections about him calling her something and following someone to the ladies' room is not a recommended move.
Yeah.
I would guess. But yeah.
And he seems so sure of the idea too. He's like, oh, we made eye contact for less than a second and she walked to the ladies' room. That means it's time to bone. You know, like
she tells him to sit down.
Yeah.
She's into it.
All right.
Not into it that much. Okay. I like when she leaves the bathroom and tells Goose that his friend was magnificent.
Yes, that's funny.
Yeah, there's a lot of funny stuff with her. I learned that the sex scene between them, which is super uncomfortable for me, is like a reaction to a test audience thing. After the screenings, people were kind of confused and disappointed that we don't get a very very clear answer of whether or not they ever hooked up, which
gotcha.
That scene certainly does clarify.
Yep.
I think without that, like, this would be a pretty nice relationship. I'm surprised that you think it's is kind of like formulaic and demeaning as it is. She's like the character of like the slightly older woman who's reluctant to kind of get mixed up with the student, kind of has her own thing, doesn't really mess up her whole life for him and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, is intelligent, and you know, eventually they do fall for each other, it seems, but and maybe a bit too easily, I would say. But overall,
yeah, there seem to be a lot of scenes missing in this movie.
Yeah. No, but I'm surprised you dislike it as much. I really didn't think it's that bad. I actually think she's really good in her part, I thought.
Okay. Well, I suppose then maybe I should just say that never underestimate my apathy towards this movie. Okay. as I was watching it, I'm certain there were times when I kind of checked out for a minute or two. So yeah, I didn't love this movie, and like was just so tired of it by the time I was even 20 minutes in, which I think is about the time she shows up. So she never had time to make an impression before I'd give it up on the movie.
You hate women so much.
Sure.
Okay, now can we talk about the music?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm just going to randomly, out of nowhere, start playing Danger Zone and take my breath away throughout this podcast. And it's just going to happen 3 or 4 times each song.
Fuck, 80s music, man. Jeez.
Yeah. You weren't a Giorgio Moroder fan?
No. I also learned very recently that REO Speedwagon was an earlier choice to do Highway to the Danger Zone.
Okay.
Which would have been a ton of fun, but they want to do their own music, I guess. I don't mind Highway to the Danger Zone. I mean, it's pretty very 80s, but, you know, it's from the 80s, so you can't blame it for that. But Take My Breath Away is honestly one of my least favorite songs ever. Like, it is excruciating to me every time it plays. Uh-huh. And at least in this movie, it kind of gets shortened down a bit. Uh-huh.
But it gets played 4 times.
You know, trust me, I am well aware of when it's being played.
Okay. It just wins the music count over Danger Zone by 1. It gets played 1 more time than Danger Zone.
Oh, and I love the, like... variations of it, or like the romantic score was based on that theme.
Yeah.
Oh, God. This soundtrack.
So what you're saying is you love the band Berlin.
Yeah, clearly. No, I hate. I don't know any more of their music, but
nobody knows anymore of their music. Yeah.
This soundtrack is like one of the most successful of all time, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
that's crazy to me.
Yeah, it was. I think it makes sense. Because this movie was huge, and I mean, both of those songs were big hits, and also it's sort of the first time where, or it's around the first time where studios are really starting to figure out ancillary markets and stuff. I'm sure you saw that this was a very popular success on home video as well. Like, just everything about this movie was incredibly popular, but yeah. But it's also a time where things can just be slightly more popular, potentially for the first time. You know, like The Big Chill had a notable soundtrack, but that came out in 1980, you know? So we have 6 more years of the marketing having heavy 80s figuring out how to trick us into buying these cassettes, you know?
Yeah. It just seems so 80s that, like, I feel like after the first few years, like, once 1990 hit, no one wants to buy this, but I guess you just did so much damage in those few years, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think anybody was completing their collection in 1995 with the Top Gun soundtrack, you know? So it's a combination of time and just having 2 incredibly popular songs on your soundtrack and driving them into people's heads, you know, yeah, throughout your movie, which was incredibly popular.
Yeah, and I think that's a point we shouldn't lose. I mean, there's a reason why people still know Top Gun, and it has some very kind of iconic lines. And I mean, to me, the aerial like fights and cinematography stuff is still up there with the best that's ever been, like, that I've ever seen, as far as I know.
Absolutely. Like, that's
I haven't seen all these, you know. I didn't see Red Tails. I mean, I haven't seen every airplane fighting movie, but it's
What about
so,
Flyboys? Like,
it's so good. No, I didn't see Flyboys either.
So maybe this is just a genre you've skipped out on. No, it's unbelievable. And especially those shots, I mentioned it very briefly, that where the camera is attached to the jet, or there's one where they fly through a cloud and it looks unbelievable. And the shots in a cockpit of a pilot that is clearly piloting an airplane. Yeah, they look gorgeous. And my problem with those sequences is that I just don't find the action engaging, despite thinking the shots are great, simply because, I don't know, there's something about an action sequence with so few limits. Like, when you're in a plane and in the sky, you can kind of just go anywhere, right? Whereas, you know, if you think to the type of action sequences that I like, or the type of action sequences that you and I have discussed, there are limits involved, you know, like they're in a room and they have these places to use. And like that Bourne Legacy fight sequence in the house, where we see every part of the house, and then we see whatever Jeremy Renner's fake Bourne character, Aaron Cross, we see Aaron Cross go through that house after it's all been set up. So we know the limitations of this world, and it's very interesting the way he interacts with them. Whereas these characters are just in the sky flying around and doing whatever works. And there are mild limitations. I mean, the 10,000 foot floor or whatever they talk about a lot, but he can just break through those limitations, you know. He's still in a plane. The amount of fuel that they have is another limitation, but That's about it, you know. And I need my fight sequences or my action sequences to have kind of real limits to what the characters can do. And there's just, maybe there's a way to do that with fighter pilots, but I don't think that happens in Top Gun. Yeah.
There's no limit on the danger zone, man. I don't know why you'd expect that. No, I know what you mean. Like, I think it all looks so good. And, you know, something we've talked about, and, you know, you kind of touched on it with the Bourne Legacy thing. Like, it's good when we know the geography of the space we're dealing with action. Mm-hmm. It's something we talk about a lot, I think.
And with the Fast and Furious movies specifically, the last couple, we've talked about that a lot.
Yeah. That's pretty relevant here. You know what I mean? Because it's three dimensional and everything. Like, you can go anywhere. I think they give you a good job of showing where the fighters are in relation to each other. And mm-hmm. I think they do a good job of that and keeping you know, that kind of geography, like relative to your enemies and your partners and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it does miss something. I agree. Like, I think it all looks so good, but it never really gets that intense for me. Like, even though I know what they are doing is so intense and like the physical strain they're going under is extremely intense. Those action scenes are really missing something for me as well, and it's not the visuals that they're missing at all, but there is something there.
Yeah,
and there's that part where they're kind of going over the canyon, going over the mountains, and there's a bit of a canyon. I thought they were going to start playing with kind of the geography of where they were there and hide behind something or something mm-hmm. like that, and that never, like, it looks like it's about to happen and never materializes, and it's just fighting in this empty space.
Yeah, and say an example of a fighter jet sequence that does kind of have these worldly limits, even specifically what you're discussing is Independence Day, where the first scene where Will Smith takes down an alien, it eventually turns into the Welcome to Earth scene. And what happens is he has to avoid, they have to go through some sort of cliff sequence from what I can recall. It's been so long since I've seen that movie. And he ends up getting the alien ship to crash into one of these rock walls. That I remember that being a pretty decent sequence. And that's just totally lacking from Top Gun, right? Another thing that I think this movie really never had a chance with me for is because I don't care about things like airplanes and motorcycles. You know, like I'm not an automobile fanatic in any way. And
a gearhead is a gearhead, yeah, we might say.
Yeah, sure.
you wouldn't know, though.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that's something that's incredibly 1980s, like, that I think has sort of dwindled with time. Like, we still care about things, but mostly it's more the number of gearheads has gone down and the people that care about just technology has gone way up. But that's something that's so 1980s about this film, and something that I think this film relies on is you seeing a guy sitting on a motorcycle watching jets fly and being envious of that person. I don't want to experience either of those two things. I would rather be in the musicless bar sitting and having a quiet conversation with a close friend, you know?
Yeah, and it's, I forget the model because I also am not a gigantic gearhead.
The term's gearhead, James.
No, that's not what I was going to say. No, but the Kawasaki motorcycle he's on at the time was the fastest production motorcycle. And, you know, I think, like you were saying, there are some people who would see that and be like, oh, if only I could do that and have that and be like that. And that's just a swing and a miss for you, because those ideas aren't appealing to you at all.
Yeah.
What I would say about just with the fighter scenes, I think it would be a bit disingenuous to kind of have all those things involved, because these are fights that normally take place, you know, thousands of feet in the air, and they're not training you on how to utilize the landscape and things mm-hmm. like that. That's not kind of what dogfighting would be about, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not saying that this movie needed was cliffs. I'm just saying I was just trying to give an example of something where that has been used in a movie that I've enjoyed, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but I
R.I.P. Harry Connick Jr.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I mean, then we get our a trope that I love, the graduation party disrupted by the emergency, like, which is so fantastic.
One of your all-time favorite tropes.
Oh, it's so good.
You go on IMDb and click on the keyword graduation party and interrupted by crisis and just watched all the films.
I do love it. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
And like Maverick almost wasn't there, which would have been a shame. So, yeah, but I mean, for that final sequence, it's just so hollow. You don't even know the enemy. There's been no talk about what this emergency is.
Yeah. It's so dependent on you being like, oh, planes are loud, loud. You know, like so much of this movie is dependent on that.
Yeah, and just wanting to be Maverick. And
yes.
I don't want to be Maverick. And you want to be Maverick even less than I want to be Maverick. So I can imagine how little you care about that.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, I guess this is a good time to bring up the politics of this movie.
Yeah.
This is an interesting movie to like sit through once and think about, at least to look at its place in pop culture, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I think part of the reason why I was bored in this movie was because I kind of knew what was going to happen, simply because it's so... it sums up a decade that I've thought about so much. It sums it up so well, you know, like, but I've just spent that time thinking about Rambo and all that shit. But yes, this is an incredibly 1980s movie. It's like a Reagan era version of, you know, Catch 22 sort of. Like you've got this fighter pilot who hates authority but still wants to be a part of the army, which stands in the contrast and makes it more Reagan era. It's like you want to help your country. And you know what's right, but sometimes the authority still gets in your way, and you've just gotta go around them, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all about individualism, which was a big thing in the 80s. And it's not like that doesn't start its roots earlier. I mean, we've talked about Dirty Harry standing in direct contrast to the Miranda rights, and like Siegel. Is it Don Siegel? I think it is. The director of Dirty Harry, basically hearing the Miranda rights ruling, and then deciding, oh, I'm going to do something about this and making a Dirty Harry movie. There's a lot of that in Maverick, the whole, I understand the rules, but I'm just not going to play by them and I'm still going to be the best, you know? And there is even a shot in this movie right at the end. I don't know if you noticed this, but behind the jukebox in the last scene, there's a picture of the man with no name. And
I did notice that.
You did?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. It's pretty large, but it's obscured a little bit, but it's there and very easy to spot. And yeah, and I thought that was a really, really nice toss in, because I feel like that really is the lead in to these sort of Clint Eastwood characters are sort of the lead in to the 1980s individualism sort of era, of which Maverick is absolutely a part of. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's this, I mean, you touched on it a bit, but it's this certain kind of individualism.
Yeah, it's like, still within the system, you know, but like you're playing the rules of, or not playing by the rules of the system, but you're still helping to advance the system that you're within, right?
Yeah, like he's a maverick, but he's a maverick who, you know, has that on his military grade helmet in the military plane that he flies.
Exactly.
For the US military, or yeah, for the US military.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, it's he never, there's you know, his boss that kind of functions as a bit of a villain for a bit because, you know, it's stopping our protagonist from doing what he wants to do whenever he wants to do it, despite how dangerous and wasteful it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who is the villain in this movie?
I don't know. Reckless abandonment.
But that's one thing that's interesting to me about this movie is that, you know, it's so formulaic in a lot of ways, and people look at it as, you know, kind of like this really cut and paste, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer action 80s, like there's not much there, you know, kind of paint by the numbers kind of thing. Like, you know, we have the rebellious protagonist and the kind of angry boss that won't let him do his thing, and then the love interest, and then his partner dies, and then the crisis of conscience, and then, you know, he comes back and wins it for everybody in the end. But there's not really a clear villain. Like, we have Iceman, we have his boss, we have Nameless Country and their MiGs.
Yeah.
But as far as like an antagonist, it's kind of fluid or absent, no?
Yes, I agree.
Doesn't that make things a little bit interesting for you?
A little bit, but I mean, it would require me caring about the movie, you know, like, I know I'm kind of using this as a cop out for a lot of things that you're bringing up as interesting, but like, I just think this movie lost me so quick that,
that first transition into Danger Zone, just garbage.
No, it's just, I don't know. No, I see your point, but it's not like it kept me up, awake last night thinking, oh, there's no real villain in that film, you know, like, there is no real villain, and that is an interesting idea. I don't think they do much with it, right? It's just sort of, it's a variety of different obstacles that stand in front of Maverick, and they shift throughout the film.
Yeah, and
he just has to learn, you know, it's a training school movie.
And I mean, he has, you know, kind of some, he has these difficulties kind of working within the system, but as you said, it's never showing that he's good and the system is bad. Like, mm-hmm. It's about him finding his way to, like, that balance between conformity that is going to make him an excellent cog in a military machine.
Yeah, for sure. But there is still that that distrust of that machine that he's a part of. Like, all of the stuff he talks about before Tom Skerritt gives him the truth about his father's death, and it's like, the stink of it was, which, great phrase choice, he screwed up, no way, you know, like, his death is classified, you know, he can't find it out because the government's hiding things from him. And there is still, and this is something that is very pervasive in 80s media, especially, you know, like, militaristic media, is that there's still something that the government is keeping from you, and you have to fight through the government red tape so that you can win. And it's all like, I don't know, it's very much this post-Vietnam sort of thing, where I think Reagan in a debate in 1980 talked about how the U.S. was fighting the Vietnam War with one hand tied behind their back, and then spent a lot of time in his speeches talking about how, you know, the government was afraid to let America win the Vietnam War and all this shit. And that's sort of what developed into this individualism with Maverick. And there is still this really... I don't know. It's weird. It's like you're fighting against the old authority, but still a true patriot. You know, like, I don't think anybody would argue that Maverick doesn't see himself as a patriot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but he is still, he's trying to figure out the flaws in the system that he has found himself within. It very much is in contrast to the way things went in Vietnam, and the total public distrust of the government because of that, and Watergate, and the way that Reagan tried to make the government more trustable was to turn it into sort of an army, you know, like, or to treat himself like the head of an army. Like, he was the first president to be called the commander in chief, which is this very militaristic term. And yeah, it's sort of, you can be a loose cannon inside the government, but, you know, you're still trying to correct some of its errors, you know. I don't know, that was mumbly, and but there's, I don't know.
I know what you're saying, like, yeah. It's even when there is kind of these discrepancies of opinions of how to go about things, the goal is kind of always to just have this functioning perfectly, and you get this line, you know, early on, it's like, hey, we don't do policies here, mm-hmm. which stands out as a kind of a weird line, because no one's talking about policies at that point. Like, yeah. It's all just kind of like, we're not the decision makers. We get this all from above. That's kind of not our business. We're here to kind of make you a part of the system and to do that. And, you know, maybe there's kind of these struggles of personality about how they're all going to fit in together. But there's never any doubt that this is obviously the system you want to be a part of.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And to talk about Tom Skerritt again, who I think is really good in this movie, like he is in most things.
Yeah, exactly. Tom Skerritt's a good actor.
Yeah. You know, I think he embodies what we're talking about really well, because, you know, they butt heads early on and he disapproves, but he's still very supportive of Maverick. You know what I mean? He's still very, as much as they often disagree, he's always, oh, you know, put him back up in the air. Like, we're going to keep him on. We're going to keep him going. There's still something left in him. And he quickly transitions into that father figure as soon as Maverick's, you know, almost or has left or is going to leave Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that's where we kind of get this flip from him, an authority figure, and, you know, as part of the military, as part of this machine that Maverick's having a hard time fitting into, and then switch into this father figure. And, you know, oh, I was in Vietnam with your dad. I was on that mission when he disappeared. I know he's a great guy. This is what really happened to him. And it's, you know, one of the first times, like, we really get these big shots of domestic places in California instead of, like, just the base. You know, we even see a bit of Charlie's house, but not really much of it, just inside. You do get kind of this neighborhood feel, like you actually get, and it's actually really like a very aesthetically pleasing shot of some of the stuff of his neighborhood when they're outside.
It's so close to being the most gorgeous shot of the movie, but the top of the house is cut off. It's so close to being an amazing shot, and they just didn't quite fit the house in frame.
But, okay, because I remember, maybe it's not, you know, the shots immediately preceding it, but there's a good stretch of that movie that struck me at least as actually looking really nice and not just cool action stuff, but some.
Oh, I think this is a well-shot movie.
Shot. Yeah.
Okay. I think this is a well-shot movie.
Yeah. I think, cause we only really talked about, like, you know, the plane stuff and the action up in the air, but mm-hmm. I think there is some really nice stuff on the ground at that graduation when they kind of crane in over that pool and it's really done really symmetrically. I think that's a really nice shot.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, his, Tom Skerritt there just, again, kind of just showing, like, you know, there's this figure ahead of you that you need to approve, that you need their approval of, and you need to play by their rules. But it's also your dad. It's also family. It's also this soft part. And it's this, you know, combination of those two ideas. And, you know, I think that's what you're getting at with this, the conformity of the 80s and the individualism and that we find in so many of the protagonists in cinema at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And even like protagonists of and even protagonists outside of cinema, like the 80s is the decade Michael Jordan starts taking over as being like this lone superstar. Right. And not that sports always lacked these individual superstars. But, you know, there's a clear demarcation from Michael Jordan and anybody that comes before him. And you can see that with Wayne Gretzky as well in hockey. And those are very individual, despite the fact that they exist within teams, and Gretzky particularly was known for his assisting abilities, but they were still seen as these unbelievable individuals, you know. And that was just sort of a way that culture sort of moved into talking about people and talking about accomplishments, is that it became more interesting to talk about an individual accomplishment than it did for any sort of group, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to remember one face than it is to remember eight.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Like, I can't remember Slider's name. It's because I'm a child of the 80s.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I was just, yeah. Let's talk about the military's participation in this movie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we said there are these, you know, at the time, our main character, who, you know, the viewer is always supposed to relate to and kind of watch the movie through their eyes, you know, butt some heads with figures in the military, but we're never really meant to see the military as the villain. Mm-hmm. And even when Maverick is talking about his dad's death as being, you know, still a mystery to him, he doesn't really seem begrudged of the military at all. You know what I mean? Like, he kind of just accepts it as the situation. There's never really any criticism of this, like, never any meaningful criticism of this big machine or how it treats its citizens.
Oh, no, no.
Like,
I mean, there's no meaningful criticism of anything in this movie.
True. Fair enough. Some of Tom Cruise's eyebrows outside the movie, but.
Oh, yeah. I've got pages of notes of how did this happen? Who let this happen?
But they, The script changed a lot once in order to get the U.S. Navy involved, because the producers did want the U.S. Navy involved because they want to use their real equipment and their expertise and everything like that. So they ran the script by the U.S. Navy, who had some changes to be made for it. Mm-hmm. The dogfight at the beginning was changed from Cuba to international waters. Okay. Just to reduce controversy, which yeah. makes a lot of sense to me. The language was toned down, which is, you know, not
which
my
is malarkey.
Yeah, exactly. And also not my understanding of how the military works, but yeah. okay. And I guess there was supposed to be a scene that with involving a plane crashing on the deck of an aircraft carrier, and so that was gone. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was Charlie, Maverick's love interest, used to be an enlisted member of the Navy.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I read in the original draft of the script, she was an aerobics teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Which blew my goddamn mind when I read it. You want to talk about their relationship being problematic. The second she becomes an aerobics instructor instead of being in any sort of position within the Air Force, then, yeah, it becomes way worse than what we have discussed.
No, I think what happened is originally it was the aerobics instructor, and then... rewrites they did on their own changed it to an enlisted
yes, okay.
member, and then the Navy changed it to a civilian contractor because
there's which they make very clear.
Well, kind of, and then she wears a bunch of military gear throughout yeah. on an Air Force base, which would be really unacceptable.
At one point, Michael Ironside says, "She is a civilian, you do not need to salute yeah. her."
Yeah. I like that, though.
Yeah. Oh, anything Michael Ironside says is okay with me. I like that guy.
He's such a small part in this movie.
But yeah, he's one of those character actors that is so good in everything, you know?
Yeah.
And this is in that time where he was very present. Yeah. Mid 80s to mid 90s, he was in pretty much everything and great in all of it.
Yeah. One of the other interesting things I saw about the military's participation in this, you know, because they still had to rent the military's equipment. Like, even though the military made these changes in order for them to cooperate, they still, you know, had them pay for fuel and maintenance costs for these planes that otherwise wouldn't have been in the air mm-hmm. because, you know, taxpayer money, as is said in this movie, is very important. You don't own those planes, Maverick.
There are at least two times where somebody mentions the owner and or the cost of the planes that Maverick's flying, and I found that really interesting.
Yeah, why?
Just because, element of the system that Maverick exists within but doesn't care about. You know, he doesn't care who owns the plane. He doesn't care how much it costs. He's too dangerous. You can't control him. He's a Maverick.
So dangerous. Yeah. Yeah,
I don't like you because you're dangerous. That's such a goddamn good line. Oh, no. And then Maverick saying, "Yeah, I'm dangerous," and then like touching his shoulder, and then I don't remember what he says after that, but it's so funny to me.
And then when Iceman kind of like bites at him at one point.
Oh god.
And I'm a huge Val Kilmer fan, so those parts crack me up a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a fan of the Kilmer as well, which always confuses me because he's in so few actually good things. But I still, like, anytime he's in something, it immediately makes me more likely to see it, you know?
Even though it's more likely a bad movie.
Oh, definitely. I remember there was a movie that came out like the mid-2000s called Mindhunters. And I was like on the fence about going to see it. And I was like, oh, Val Kilmer's in this. Okay, it's probably going to suck, but I'll still see it because Val Kilmer's in it. It's still one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, what I was going to say about the Navy there was Paramount Pictures offered them, they said, you know, we'll put a 90-second Navy recruiting ad before the movie on this video cassette. Mm-hmm. If you give us $1 million in credit, because it costs them something like $8,000 an hour to use a plane. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, an aircraft carrier would be a lot more, obviously. So that will give you a commercial and, you know, you can, you know, take some money off the budget here. But there's an internal memo from the Pentagon to the advertising agency that offered them the idea.
Yeah.
And the memo said, it was about this movie and another movie, actually. It's offering something similar, but the quote is, "Both movies are already wonderful recruiting tools for the military, particularly the Navy, and to add a recruiting commercial onto the head of what is already a 2-hour recruiting commercial is redundant," which is fantastic.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, just in the transparency of that they think this is just a 2-hour commercial for something.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we said, like, they would not support that if there was any real criticism of the military. So, like, any of the kind of friction between them has to be so, so light that we never think the military or the U.S. or the Navy or, you know, this commander are that bad, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep, for sure. Yeah. So do you think Jerry Bruckheimer had a hotline to the Pentagon at the time this movie was made?
I don't know. I know Tony Scott wrote a $25,000 check to turn an aircraft carrier around.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk about something. We mentioned this, that I like Tony Scott. I also, you mentioned earlier people just sort of writing off the Bruckheimer Simpson films. And I think most Bruckheimer Simpson films are more interesting than anybody gives them credit for, particularly the ones Tony Scott does. You know, I find Michael Bay very interesting. Like, I mean, it's not like Gone in 60 Seconds was a fascinating piece of culture. But, you know, we talked about Enemy of the State and how that's kind of about the Patriot Act before the Patriot Act existed. I was just watching Crimson Tide the other day, and it's very much, I don't know, it's a lot more interesting than I thought it would be, because it's mostly a 2-hour discussion between Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington about whether or not we should use nuclear weapons. And I found that really fascinating. Okay. Something that I found both watching Crimson Tide and Top Gun, Crimson Tide being another Tony Scott movie. Michael Bay loves Tony Scott. And we haven't really talked about the orange-green tint in a lot of shots in the in Top Gun. But that was all over Michael Bay's early career, where the sky was just more orange. And in Top Gun, the water was always more green in those shots, and the deck of the carrier as well. And those shots were very much a part of Michael Bay's early career, definitely in Bad Boys and The Rock, and probably one in Armageddon. Like just watching Crimson Tide, the beginning of that movie just looks like the beginning of The Rock, and it was really crazy. They came out around the same time, used the same sort of score, same composer. And Michael Bay also wrote a $25,000 check to get a climactic shot in Bad Boys. And I was really curious to know, and I never found this out, I couldn't find anything, if Michael Bay knew that when he wrote the script and was just like, I'm being like one of my heroes, or when he was on set and being one of his heroes and writing this check. And I just thought that was really funny. I know those are both movies produced by the Bruckheimer Simpson umbrella. So I think it both gives Bruckheimer and Simpson a bit more credit as far as their producerial voice. And also just I very clearly shows one of Michael Bay's main influences, I think. Michael Bay probably fucking loves Top Gun.
Oh, I can imagine he would have been a big fan of that when it came out. Yeah. And I mean, Tony Scott as well also came, you know, from commercials and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. The last shot of this movie, it's Maverick and Charlie framed from in profile facing each other and going into kiss. And the thing in between them is a Pepsi logo. It's behind them on the wall, and it's a neon Pepsi logo, and they kiss over it, and it fades to black. And I was like, that is a straight up advertisement. And there is Pepsi all throughout the movie. Pepsi was very clearly a sponsor of this film, but I couldn't believe, like, in the last shot, it was like Pepsi is what brings these two people together. It was really funny.
Yeah, no, Pepsi was huge. They had a commercial on the VHS tape before the movie. they filled in for the Navy slot, I guess. But no, I mean, you mentioned how successful this was and how this was them, you know, really kind of figuring out how to monetize movies in a way just beyond ticket sales. And based on just pre-orders, this became the best-selling video cassette in the industry's history.
That's
which
so
is
funny.
Pretty incredible. Also the first video cassette in the $20 price range, which is adorable to me. but no, I want to talk about Tony Scott some more, because
I'm in.
Yeah, I thought you would be. Yep. I found a quote from Owen Weekly, who I'm sure you have come across.
Sorry, you cut out Owen Gleiberman, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
and this was shortly after Tony Scott's death. He said, the propulsive, at times borderline preposterous popcorn thriller storylines, the slice and dice editing and the images that somehow managed to glow with grit, the fireball violence often glimpsed in smeary techno telephoto shots, the way he had of making actors seem volatile and dynamic at the same time, lacking almost any subtext, were qualities of Scott's films that both excited audiences about his work and kept him locked outside the gates of critical respectability.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't disagree. Yeah.
And you do think that there is kind of just beyond, you know, it, because he has kind of, you know, as they say here, locked outside the gates of critical respectability. He is certainly not taken as seriously as other directors, as, mm-hmm. you know, his brother.
Well, we talked about this after he died. His brother has made two films better than anything Tony Scott ever made. But I think on average, Tony Scott's average film, like if there was some sort of advanced analytics for for film quality, on average Tony Scott's average film is better than Ridley Scott's, you know?
Directing above replacement.
Oh, let's just turn into the Bill Barnwell of like Rotten Tomatoes or something.
Lots of sabermetric jokes.
Oh, god damn it.
but I mean, you think that's accurate, that it's, you know, kind of the way he does things made him not something that a critic who takes himself seriously would want to sign off on in a way, and that with what you're talking about with some of those other movies, there really is more of a subtext mm-hmm. to these movies than people give him credit for?
Sometimes, and I think part of it... like, I think Top Gun is interesting because of the way history sort of ended up painting the 80s, right? Mm. I don't think that, like, a lot of Tony Scott's decisions here and the filmmakers in general's decision in Top Gun helped to dictate the way the 80s would be seen, because it was one of the most popular things that happened in the 80s. But it wasn't really it wasn't much of a comment on anything at the time. And I think Enemy of the State was a very entertaining movie to watch in 1998, absolutely. And it sort of had that tying into Gene Hackman's legacy with The Conversation right out of the gate. That was interesting. But time made that a more interesting movie. It also made parts of it even more silly. But just in general, it made it more interesting. And I think another one of Tony Scott's movies that is interesting, and a movie that critics actually did like, from what I recall, is Unstoppable, his last film. That was kind of a real, like, working class sort of movie, and a comment on the death of the working class. And that was an interesting movie as well. And it's not like every movie he made was extremely interesting. Like, I haven't seen Days of Thunder, but I can't imagine it's full of meaning, you know? But yeah, he made enough that of interesting stuff that, you know, he deserved more credit than he got, for sure. But yes, I understand why he was locked out of critical acceptance, as Mr. Lieberman put it.
Yeah, I want to talk about the way people talk about Top Gun now, because he said what you're getting at was that it's not something he could ever really planned for, you know.
It was, like, very zeitgeisty.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, you get a decade removed, and then you can kind of look at how it came to be and why people interpreted everything that way, and why that's what people wanted at the time. Because, as we said, this was an incredibly popular movie in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
but I think, like, when people talk about Top Gun now, it's the first thing is always the homoerotic relationship perceived between Iceman and Maverick, and, like, I'm being serious, I think that is what people do think of the most. I mean, people kind of our age, people who kind of feel themselves to be kind of media savvy, it's kind of become this thing of, like, that was the overcharged, like, hyper masculine 80s that was, like, so intense and so obsessed with machismo that it would always accidentally fall into this homosexual category.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of that was the movie Sleep With Me, where Quentin Tarantino, you know, kind of breaks down just how gay this movie, the relationship between those characters is in this movie.
Yeah, which is, I think he stole that from Roger Avery. That's a thing that people don't know very much. Roger Avery once accused him of stealing that speech from him. And
I didn't know that.
Quentin Tarantino, known thief. Yeah, so I mean that everybody has their side of the story, but that's just sort of a fact that, or a thing that people don't know about that I always like to interject. But continue. Yeah.
No, that's fine. Yeah. And I hadn't heard that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm not going to stand here and say that there aren't things that, you know, lend to that reading of this text.
Yeah, a lot of homoeroticism.
A lot of things that can be perceived that way. Mm-hmm. You know, Maverick, it's even pointed out that Maverick seems to have had sex with something that wasn't a woman at a previous bet. So
that's something I actually found interesting about this movie was that, you know, even like as a joke, if it was a joke in the 80s that he didn't immediately be like, no, I wouldn't have sex with a guy. Like, I thought that was really progressive.
Yeah, and he's kind of just like, nah.
That was actually, yeah, that was one of the things in this movie I actually was like, wait, what? Did that happen? That progressiveness thing snapped in me. I was like, this is way ahead of its time. That wouldn't happen in an action movie now, you know?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, but I mean, to go back to Quentin Tarantino's reading, and I mean, if we're going to talk about... you know, media savvy people of our generation, Quentin Tarantino, I think, would be kind of an idol of that. You know, yeah. Not that he's of our generation, but he's someone idolized by our generation and the people that I'm describing.
And somebody that was a script doctor for the Bruckheimer Simpson umbrella for a while as well in the 90s.
Yeah.
Probably at the time that Sleep With Me came out.
And had a movie, you know, he wrote True Romance, which Tony Scott would later go on to direct.
Exactly.
But my the thing about that reading is it's really bad. Like it's really inaccurate. Like I just rewatched that scene in Sleep With Me.
Yeah.
I've never seen the whole movie, but I've seen that clip a few times.
That's everybody's everybody's history with that movie.
I was like, what movie was that even in? Like I can picture this scene, but I can't even think of the title of that movie or any characters or other actors in it. But his reading of that is that Charlie Kelly McGillis is heterosexuality and Iceman and his crew are homosexuality. And, you know, they're kind of having this tug of war with Maverick. You know, she's trying to say play by the rules and stay straight. And Iceman's trying to pull him the other way. This like back and forth on him doesn't really exist in the movie.
His theory is dubious.
Yeah, those two theories. Aren't like they really don't line up with what's actually on screen. And then, you know, in the whole the big finale of that, what is meant to be the funniest part is when they both say that final line at the same time, where Sleep With Me says, you know, and what's the last part, the last line Iceman and Maverick have together is you can be my tailman anytime, bullshit, you can be mine. That's not the line. So you could, like, it's straight up not the line, which is shocking that no kind of script supervisor didn't interject with that. It's you can be my wingman anytime. And I mean, feel free to read into the homosexuality of that line as well. But
they just cuddle.
Well, yeah. Or help each other pick up women, which is what wingmen actually do. I'm just stuck on this whole thing of how like, the fact that like even literally the facts of what he's describing take place in this movie are incorrect, let alone how you're supposed to interpret them. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted kind of your idea of how this movie like kind of became this thing that the 80s were so goofy and silly and all that was so bad that, you know, everyone was so misguided in the search for, you know, being so masculine that it accidentally turned homosexual and like that. A smart 90s movie goer has to hate Top Gun and has to see it as so misguided that they didn't even know what movie they were writing or performing. You know what I mean?
Well, to, you know, kind of defend Quentin Tarantino a little bit, something I actually, his incorrect facts in that monologue, I think are interesting. Whether or not they're intentional, I think that kind of, I don't know. It makes the speech more interesting to me because it's kind of like a guy subtly lying to make his point more correct, which is something that would absolutely happen in a casual conversation at a party with somebody he may or may not have any previous relationship with, right?
Yeah.
That's something that feels true to life for what I perceive that scene in that movie to be without any of the surrounding context, you know, without anything outside of that 3-minute YouTube clip. But yeah, I think part of that reaction is based on Tom Cruise's eventual, or very quickly after Top Gun, his cultural ubiquity. Like, just, he was everywhere, starting with Top Gun through pretty much the end of the 90s. And younger people kind of seem to get tired of him. I don't know who his core audience was, but it didn't seem to be people in our, well, certainly not our age group. I was born the year this movie came out. You were not born. But all through the 90s, when we were kids, it always seemed like everybody kind of hated Tom Cruise, even though he was obviously the biggest star on the planet. Yeah. And that remains today. Like, I still get in arguments when I'm like, no, Tom Cruise is awesome. And people are like, yeah, he's the worst. And I'm like, defend your point, please. And Travis and I actually emailed a bit about this recently. I don't remember the context, but I made a point about how much I like Tom Cruise. And he was like, oh, I don't. And his girlfriend, I think, wouldn't watch anything with Tom Cruise in it. And he made a point about Tom Cruise having this sort of like level of self-assuredness that people of our generation aren't okay with. And I thought
that is a good point, because we're too, like, we don't want anything seriously. Like, we would never really say we like anything. It's better to have that ironic, like, detachment from everything, including your own personality.
Exactly. And I thought, like, when Travis sent me that email, I was like, holy shit. Like, I know I've spent more time thinking about Tom Cruise than you. You win. Like, you have perfectly summed up how people think about Tom Cruise and where the backlash to Tom Cruise came from. Because that's something that's very part of the 90s mindset, is direct reaction against the 80s. It's like, oh, the 80s was all about caring about furthering yourself. The 90s was Reality Bites and trying to just exist, man, you know, like, and just just being Ethan Hawke's character in Reality Bites, not Ben Stiller's. Ben Stiller was the 80s, Ethan Hawke was the 90s. And that's how people saw Tom Cruise. They saw him as Maverick. They saw him as this guy that that saw what he wanted and was going to get it. And you can say that about Maverick in Top Gun. You can say that about Tom Cruise in his career. Like, he I'm sure we've talked about it on the podcast somewhere, but he was very calculated in his choices. That was part of the reason why there wasn't a Top Gun 2. I think he eventually agreed to do it if they paid him an insane, like, he priced himself out of the job. And, you know, Paula Wagner, his publicist throughout the 80s and 90s, really limited his interviews. She had this rule that she got to destroy the tapes after the interviews were edited, like the finished pieces were on television.
So weird, Al can't make him say something silly.
yeah, exactly. And he fires his publicist months before the Oprah couch incident, and hires his sister, who has no previous publicist experience. But yeah, he was just this very controlled property in media, and it was impossible to really get anything out of him outside of his actual work. And because of that, it made it seem like the only thing Tom Cruise cared about was work, and that's something 90s kids absolutely cannot deal with. You know? Oh, you like work? Ew, gross. I can't handle this. I need my Lisa Loeb records, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that is where a lot of the Tom Cruise hate comes from, and where a lot of the Top Gun hate comes from, just because, to kind of disagree with your point about the first thing people talking about being the hip homoeroticism of this movie, I think the first thing that people talk about whenever Top Gun is brought up is Tom Cruise.
Who
is a central part of the thing you mentioned, but
yeah, you know. And also has the homosexuality thing totally mixed up with his mythos at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, when you're talking about, you know, his self-assuredness being off-putting, I think of, you know, the last 10 years and Seth Rogen being so big. And I think of him trying to, you know, his scene with Katherine Heigl in the bar, it knocked up, versus Tom Cruise's scene with Kelly McGillis in this. Yeah. And like, Seth Rogen's not even trying at first. Like, he's just like, well, she's way out of my league and all this kind of stuff. And I understand that they look much differently and that plays into that. But I think it's a good point that I hadn't thought of, that kind of level of confidence and that level of, you know, him just saying like, oh, I don't know, but I'll tell you tomorrow morning how a plan goes. Things like that. Just that's such a villain line in the past, like 30, 20 years. I mean, that to have that be your protagonist, I could see that being off-putting. And yeah, I think, you know, in the 90s, to look back on the 80s, and again, I say this as someone who's barely, you know, forming my own opinions in the 90s, for them to like, and for Quentin Tarantino especially, to kind of be this voice of, you know, let's not do things like the 80s. Let's not do, let's not just continue to conform and do whatever makes the most money. Let's do something interesting. Let's do something different. Even if we have these references and this pastiche of the past, let's do things differently. And I think, you know, kind of maligning Top Gun, and you know what, I don't think it's a great movie. I think I like it more than you do, but I don't think it's like a very good movie that I want to watch over and over on its own merit.
I never want to see a second of this movie again.
Yeah, you do. You want to see the seconds with Anthony Daniels Goose
Edwards. Anthony Edwards.
Anthony, that's right. Anyway, that's the other person. Anyway,
that's that other person named Anthony.
That's C-3PO, actually.
Yes.
I think, you know, when you were talking about that, I think like the way people talk, like the way people talk about Top Gun then, I think, is the way people talk about Michael Bay now. Like, he's just, you know, the worst of everything in Hollywood, and it, to be like a truly, you know, to be a cinephile, to be a truly media savvy person, you have to reject those kind of big things. And I think that that became part of, you know, why it was so necessary to reject Top Gun, like, as soon as the 90s started.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, anytime something is as big as Top Gun is, eventually people are going to turn on it. Even people that paid for their tickets to go see Top Gun and probably liked it the first time, eventually...
And bought a bomber jacket after they watched it.
Yeah, exactly. Eventually, you get a backlash to something, anything as popular as this, you know?
Yeah. And we see that with this movie, and we see that with Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Cool. Anything else?
No.
Top Gun sequel about drones, going to be politically interesting and never happen?
It might happen, but it will not be politically interesting.
Okay. So stay tuned for our podcast on a boring Top Gun 2.
I know I've told you about Transformers 4. You're just talking about Michael Bay being the worst aspect of Hollywood. And again, big Michael Bay fan over here. But Transformers 4, like the first 20, 25 minutes of it is super interesting because it's about drones. And it's like about drones in kind of an interesting way. And then they just throw it away. And that's what Top Gun 2 would do. It would be like, there are drones until we don't need the drones to make the action cool anymore. You know, like, we're not going to say anything about it. So Top Gun 2 will be Top Gun 2, and, you know, probably won't be politically interesting. maybe 30 years later it will be, but yeah.
Yeah.
Not like, when it comes out.
Like this has ended up being.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed our conversation about this movie way more than I enjoyed watching this movie.
And I hope the listener did too.
So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Again, be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about sports and Kubrick, which are two things that go hand in hand. But yeah, thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening. Watching every motion in my foot, love.